The Laura Murphy Show, episode 32.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Hey everybody, Bob Murphy here. For this episode of the Laura Murphy Show, we're going to do something a little bit different. We have commissioned the narrator, the woman whose voice you hear on the intro and outro of every episode, we've commissioned her to read the introduction to the book that Carlos and I wrote called How Privatized Banking Really Works. So this is the book where Carlos and I integrate Austrian economics with Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept, or IBC. So if you want to think of it this way, this is the book that ultimately launched the Laura Murphy podcast, Laura Murphy Show, which you're listening to and you love on a regular basis, of course. If you want to get the actual book, go to lauramurphy.com and then click on the resources tab and then scroll down and you'll see there's a list of the books that we've authored, and this is one of them. So if you want to get your hands on the physical book after hearing the introduction, you just can't stand it. You need to get the whole book. Again, go to lara-murphy.com and then click on the resources button, which is going to be in the middle of the top scroll bar. In the meantime, sit back and enjoy as our narrator reads the introduction to How Privatized Banking Really Works.
How Privatized Banking Really Works. Acknowledgements. In addition to all the great thinkers who have taught us so much over the years, either in person or indirectly through their books, we would like to specifically thank a few people who were instrumental in the creation of this work. The entire teams at both the Lafayette Life Insurance Company and Mutual Trust Life Insurance Company graciously allowed us to visit their offices in order to learn about the inner workings of whole life insurance. We should single out David Francis of Lafayette, who arranged for the meeting in the first place. Roger Barth and Stephen Botza of Mutual Trust went above and beyond the call of duty in fielding our questions about cash values and policy loans. David Stearns, president of the Infinite Banking Concept think tank in Birmingham, Alabama, has extended to us every bit of assistance as we completed the book. David Gordon and Stephen Kinsella assisted with the Austrian side of our research. Alvin Abeloof and Stephanie Long created the gripping cover design, which is arguably the best attribute of the book. Finally, we would like to especially thank Anne Laura for acting as liaison with the publishing company and for the scores of hours she put into the preparation of the manuscript. Were it not for Anne, this book would still consist of a collection of Word documents on the author's respective hard drives. Part 1. The Quandary. You are about to read a unique book. It will both diagnose our nation's economic woes and then offer a realistic solution. It will discuss the symptoms of the quandary that all Americans have perceived, but it will explain them in a way you may never before have encountered. After you understand the problem, this book will explain a practical cure that you can implement immediately. This book covers much ground. It shows that our current crisis, as well as the general financial struggle afflicting almost all Americans, is not due to cosmic coincidence. It is also not just the way things are. No, our quandary has very specific causes. Fiat money and the practice of fractional reserve banking and the government interventions that perpetuate them. In a very real sense, our modern financial system creates money out of thin air and can destroy it just as quickly. This magical ability gives rise to the familiar boom-bust cycle in developed economies. The recognition of this troubling fact implies no moral condemnation of the millions of people currently employed in the commercial banking sector. Most of them probably have no idea that our entire financial system rests on quicksand. The mechanics of fractional reserve banking can be difficult to grasp. And indeed, many people will need to read this book several times before they truly understand it. But once they do, they will be shocked. Households have the ability to secede from this chaotic financial system. They can turn to traditional insurance companies rather than commercial banks and Wall Street for their financing needs. We explain all of this in due time. Yet before offering a solution, we must first understand the quandary. It is monstrous. Chapter 1, Introduction, by Carlos Lara. From Ludwig von Mises. No one can find a safe way out for himself if society is sweeping towards destruction. Therefore, everyone, in his own interests, must thrust himself vigorously into the intellectual battle. None can stand aside with unconcern. The interests of everyone hang on the results. Why do we have to have money? As the late economics professor Clarence Carson explained, this is the type of question you are most likely to hear from a young child. However, when a child asks a question like this, there is no real interest in knowing anything about the origin of money, or how it functions, or even about the fact that it is only a medium of exchange. Actually, the question stems entirely from the idea that the things the child wants cost money, and he does not have enough of it. So in essence, the child's real question is why he can't have whatever he wants, when he wants it, without there being a cost attached to it. Now, when we step back and seriously think about it, this is a very good question, and not only of children, but also of adults. It is a question that does not press on us too much, so long as things are going well economically, and we all have sufficient incomes to pay for the things we want and need. But what happens when all of that changes, as in the type of changes we are all experiencing today? All of a sudden, the alarm bells start to go off, and everyone starts clamoring for answers about money. It was actually the widespread clamor for these answers that was one of the principal motivations for the writing of this book. It all began with the alarming panic that spread throughout the world in the early fall of 2008. Here in the U.S., it was evident everywhere. Every day, for weeks on end, people were transfixed to their TV sets as they listened to things they had difficulty comprehending, but knew all too well that they were experiencing a horrific financial meltdown, unlike any other they had ever witnessed. The uncertainty the crisis created for everyone was impossible to hide, and it was apparent in everyday conversations. Most notably was the fear it generated among school children from simply observing the state of anxiety in the faces of their parents. Americans, almost in unison, came to realize in a very personal way how fragile our entire economic system had become as they witnessed giant financial structures crumble. In fact, collapse of the entire U.S. financial system did not escape anyone's mind, even the minds of the most sophisticated economic experts. Today, we are left with the aftermath of the early phases of our present financial fiasco, with many Americans now having lost their businesses, their jobs, and entire life savings. The dramatic crash of the stock market and its erratic behavior since, coupled with the collapse of the real estate market, has left people everywhere asking, "Where in the world do you put your money now?" No one, however, is or can be confident in his answer. Fear of double-digit inflation, even hyperinflation, is on the minds of many. Gold and guns, growing statistically high in demand, are evidence of the uncertainty of our future. As our nation struggles with these problems, as it attempts to redefine or create a new sense of direction, many have already lost all hope in the economic principles that once made this country great. The entire idea and hope of a free market economy is in crisis. A recent British Broadcasting Corporation poll across 27 different countries showed 89% of the 29,000 individuals questioned were disillusioned with capitalism. This is why those of us who still believe in the market and want no part of socialism are demanding reliable answers to help unravel all of the financial confusion. Of course, this is not a new problem. As new as it may seem to our present generation in 2010, the struggle for the control over money is as old as mankind. But one sure place to begin the query about money within the United States is with this stark and paramount realization. Our money is not fully in our control. The central bank of the United States, the Federal Reserve, has a complete monopoly on our money. And this control is mandated by our federal government. This domination of our entire monetary system has had severe economic and moral ramifications. The effects of this monopoly are the prime reason why the value of our money has fallen some 95% since the Federal Reserve's founding in 1913, and it is the direct cause of our current financial crisis. We cannot ever hope to begin to see money with clarity until this realization is exposed and fully understood. To begin talking about the free market, money, savings, interest, credit, investments, or banking, without first having a complete grasp of this truth, the fact that we are under the grip of a centrally planned money mechanism leads nowhere but to even greater confusion and disenchantment. However, in order for this truth to be fully grasped by the average U.S. citizen, to the degree that public opinion can effect a real change at the top echelons of government, will take nothing short of a miracle. How in the world do you take the printing press away from government once they have had full use of it all these many years? Until this is done, our United States will continue to head down a path of social, political, and economic destruction. Yes, it is true. It is also hugely overwhelming and hopeless, too big to fix. In fact, just how would one go about changing such a monstrous problem when life is short and the moment of a possible victory so far in the future? Why even bother? What is the point of even trying? Well, first of all, consider this, and consider it seriously. If change does not occur here in this country, a country where change is still possible, there is no place else left on this planet for an escape. The entire world operates by this same closed and controlled monetary system. Government-mandated paper money and banking systems are everywhere. In the United States, the central bank is the Federal Reserve. In the UK, the central bank is the Bank of England. In Italy, it is the European Central Bank, and so on in every major foreign country. The power and growth of governments everywhere are fueled by these monopoly systems, and their growth has cut into the quality of life for all individuals to staggering proportions. It is like a virus, parasitic in nature, and which will eventually kill the host. If we do not make an effort to change it here in our country now, it will never change. And if we do not step forward to help change it, no one will. Second, there is no rational reason to work myself and you, the reader, up into a revolutionary frenzy unless we stop long enough to realize that we are losing something very precious, our freedom. To bring this into perspective, consider that the abundance that we see and have, our high standard of living that most of us enjoy today, came into existence by a movement germinated from the idea of freedom. This movement exploded here in this country from the colonial days until 1914, a very brief period of some 150 years. Compared to the entire history of the world, this is amazing. We must therefore reverse this trend, for it is possible that we may never have the opportunity to do so again. From Murray Rothbard. Take the great classical liberal revolutionary movement of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. These our ancestors created a vast, sprawling, and brilliant revolutionary movement, not only in the United States, but throughout the Western world, that lasted for centuries. This was the movement largely responsible for radically changing history, for almost destroying history as it was previously known to man. For before these centuries, the history of man, with one or two luminous exceptions, was a dark and gory record of tyranny and despotism, a record of various absolute states and monarchs crushing and exploiting their underlying populations, largely peasants who lived a brief and brutish life at bare subsistence, devoid of hope or promise. It was a classical liberalism and radicalism that brought to the mass of people that hope and that promise, and which launched the great process of fulfillment. All that man has achieved today in progress, in hope, in living standards, we can attribute to the revolutionary movement, to that revolution. This great revolution was our father. It is now our task to complete its unfinished promise. Third, and most important, is that a movement for real change cannot possibly be effective if it starts from the top down, government down to the individual citizen. The genesis for change must start with the individual. It must have the individual as the principal criterion and spread out and up from there. This happens only when the individual's economic survival questions are answered to his full satisfaction, and when he experiences immediate results for himself in the endeavor he embarks upon. That is what this book is about. This is of crucial importance. When there are immediate benefits to the individual from his productive efforts, the individual takes notice and immediately seeks to duplicate them. When he sees that the benefits he gains also help society as a whole, he is encouraged and motivated to involve others, beginning with his own family members and then everyone else within his circle of contacts. This type of good news always spreads, slowly in the beginning, but then suddenly it turns into an evangelistic explosion. A movement that works in this manner can quickly take on a life of its own and spread until public opinion grows, forcing the upper echelons of government to make vital and necessary changes. In the end, all economic policies are ultimately dependent on the views of the general public, and their choice is final. It is the masses that determine the course of history, but its initial movement must start with the individual. For these three important reasons, this book contains information to guide and empower the individual. It describes in detail three independent ideas that are already at work, spreading and gaining momentum throughout the grassroots of our country. The people and institutions involved with these ideas are wonderfully creative. Although distinct, these ideas are so uniquely intertwined that bringing them together as one powerful multidimensional element in this book was natural. These three ideas are Austrian economics, the sound money solution, and privatized banking, as best described by the infinite banking concept, a book written by R. Nelson Nash. Once fully understood, these three ideas provide the basis for a formula with powerful turnaround dynamics that may be implemented by virtually any individual. The result is a private economic enterprise and self-perpetuating teaching tool that provides the individual the savings, banking, and financing capabilities he needs to acquire all of his material needs, plus the power to literally reconstruct national monetary policy. It is these benefits that are the key to keeping the individual inspired as he spreads the message to others. As the message grows, public opinion will change. This powerful combination is the new idea presented in this book. This is finally a solution that answers the question of what one person can actually do that will make a difference in an economic environment that has gone terribly awry. When you begin first with the individual's own private economic affairs, things change immediately for the better. It becomes the individual's escape route to freedom. Furthermore, the sound money solution supports this idea, and Austrian economics confirms it. More importantly, the individual can go into the economic enterprise immediately, regardless of the bridled money system he may be in, and what is going on all around him in the present social, political, and economic environment, although his hope rests in the ultimate triumph of the sound money solution, which is changing the national monetary policy. The process he is engaging helps thrust forward the Austrian economic message while advancing his own personal economic benefits in the here and now. The idea is so rational that it should not be difficult to grasp at all. All that is required is an open mind, the understanding of a few undeniable economic principles, the use of sincere conviction, common sense, imagination, courage, and above all, discipline. Hopefully, in these first few beginning paragraphs, the reader's appetite has been whetted enough to want to become more acquainted with the process. After understanding the idea clearly and giving it serious thought, it will naturally follow that the reader will want to embark upon the endeavor. Enacting, by implementing the process in his own economic affairs, the reader confirms the immediate benefits of the idea and assures himself that it does, in fact, really work. This, in turn, leads one into telling others about one's newfound independence and freedom, thereby spreading the solution for our country everywhere. Ignoring the Austrians got us in this mess. In bringing together all of the thoughts contained in this book, it is important for the reader to know that I have received an enormous amount of help and to recognize the source of that help. This is important because if the reader is to implement the idea presented here, he will ideally need to take very similar steps for a more in-depth and complete understanding of it. First of all, I have benefited immensely by being a student and passionate reader of the writings of the great classical natural law theorists found in Austrian economics. These men, several of whom predated Adam Smith, who famously gave expression to laissez-faire in 1776, have come down to us through written history, illuminating the difficult and the unseen on all things having to do with economics. In my own personal search for the truth in the economic and financial realm, I have found no parallel and only wish that I had heard about them earlier in my life. What a difference that would have made. In March of 2009, just 6 months after the economic crisis occurred, a rare and interesting article appeared in the financial publication Barron's entitled, "Ignoring the Austrians Got Us in This Mess." The article pointed out that the Austrian prescriptions to solve the world's economic problems were first ignored by the New Deal of Franklin D. Roosevelt. That was 75 years ago. A grim reminder that the refusal to accept sound economic thinking has gone on in this country for quite some time. Instead, Keynesian economics has now become entrenched in society everywhere. Every major university from Harvard on down is vested in this erroneous way of economic thinking. Across party lines, as substantiated by the Bush and now the Obama administration, with the $700 billion TARP in late 2008 and the $787 billion stimulus a few months later, the rejection of sound economics obviously continues. Therefore, without question, one of the principal and imperative goals of this book is for each reader to be inspired by an urgent quest for knowledge of Austrian economics. This does not imply that one must go back to school and become an economic scholar, but rather to take up reading it on a regular and consistent basis. Today, with the help of the internet, it is easy. Only by seeing the world from the Austrian economic point of view Is one able to sort out and distinguish good economics from bad economics? Educating yourself. Learning of the origins and basic tenets of Austrian economics is obviously the first step. It will not take long in one's search to eventually be led to the Mises Institute, Mises.org, and the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE.org, two of the leading and most recognized independent organizations committed to spreading free market ideas here in the United States. At these two websites, you will find a world of illuminating economic articles, books, CDs, DVDs, and scholarly journals that can be obtained from these fine private institutions, much of it for free. If the reader is hearing of the Austrian School of Thought for the very first time, these private institutions are certainly the best place to start and continue acquiring the education needed. However, for purposes of simplification, here is what may be considered the most important distinctions of this particular school of economic thinking. First of all, it is important to realize that the Austrian school, although worldwide, is now most centrally located in the United States. It is not a physical school or place, but rather an economic way of thinking. Its predecessors first originated in Spain in the 16th century, but some of the more influential Austrian scholars were from Vienna, Austria. As a general rule, the principle of scarcity and the concept of choice are at the center of Austrian economics. Every action by every actor in an economy has its own set of values, preferences, needs, desires, and time schedules for the goals intended to be reached. Why? Because economic value is subjective to the individual. This makes the Austrian economist see the complexity of an economy, and especially the market, as uniquely different from all other schools of thought. What is remarkable to me, even now, is that contrary to the fact that Wall Street, the media, and most of our political leaders in Washington were caught completely by surprise when the financial crisis hit us all in 2008, the Austrians had been predicting it all along, and they had been doing it for decades. There are many great foreign scholars who could be classified as Austrian economists, regardless of their nationality. These include the French classical economists Jean-Baptiste Say and Friedrich Bastiat. The actual founding of the Austrian school occurred in 1871 with the publication of Karl Menger's Grundsätze, or Principles of Economics. Other foreign-born Austrians include Eugen von Bomberg, Wilhelm Rupke, and Nobel Prize-winning economist F.A. Hayek, to name just a few. American-born Austrian economists include Leonard Reed, Henry Hazlitt, and Murray N. Rothbard, with the list growing and too numerous to mention all here. However, the most celebrated figure of the Austrian school, and whose career began some 100 years ago, is Ludwig von Mises. This great Austrian economic scholar accomplished a feat never before done in the history of economics. He took centuries of scattered economic thinking and brought it all together into one complete field of study, which he called praxeology, the science of human action. In essence, this science underscored the fact that man always acts with a purpose, never in the aggregate, but always as an individual. For that reason, man cannot be placed into a formula, charted on a graph, or placed into a mathematical calculation for any type of centralized planning or forecasting, as modern-day economists insist on doing. What you learn from studying the works of Mises is that he was one of those individuals of impeccable character that comes along only rarely in history. One could say that he spent his entire life fighting an idea within civilization that was false. In fact, he believed this idea to be so delusional and destructive that he saw it as an evil that no one should give in to. In many observable ways, from his writings and lectures, it became clear that he was not so much thinking of himself, but rather looking ahead, considering us in our day and time, our kids and our grandkids, the legacy that he left behind, at a great personal cost to himself, was the encouragement for all of us to join into this intellectual battle and eventually defeat this evil idea. He believed it to be a moral responsibility that each of us, you and I, has to society. Today, it is the great work of the Mises Institute, FEE, and other such private institutes funded with no connections to powerful elites that have become the centers for learning the economic principles that our children and grandchildren must be taught. They continue to fan the flame of liberty by publishing scholarly journals, publishing books, holding conferences, teaching students, and holding seminars. Because of their efforts spanning more than 60 years here in America, hundreds of thousands have already joined in the intellectual battle, and the changes are being felt everywhere. There is faith, hope, and expectancy at these independent scholarly institutions that a dramatic change in the political and social landscape is right around the corner and can happen nearly overnight when the ideological conditions are right. These institutions continue to provide the educational fuel to keep the fire burning. Every conscientious citizen should become a member of one. Along with this book, these are the places to begin one's educational journey of Austrian economics, while at the same time staying involved in this battle over the minds of men. The Infinite Banking Concept. I acknowledge other good friends and fellow Austrians as important sources of help for the writing of this book. Dr. Paul A. Cleveland, professor of economics and finance at Birmingham Southern College, who without question is and has been my economics teacher. When we first met years ago, he was able to surmise quickly and accurately where I was in my journey into economics. He provided the necessary guidance for me to continue to move in the right direction and continues to do that to this day. There is also Canadian-born Dr. Richard J. Grant, professor of economics and finance at Lipscomb University, who provided invaluable insights into current monetary policy relating specifically to the Federal Reserve and the banking system. With his wide experience of having taught and worked in 8 different countries, his advice was instrumental in helping with missing pieces I had not yet quite figured out. And then, of course, there is my co-author of this book, Dr. Robert P. Murphy. Actually younger than some of my own children, Robert's energy and passion for his work makes him, in my opinion, a hopeful glimpse of the future of America. There are, of course, many others to whom I owe a great deal of gratitude for the thoughts provided in this book, but with many apologies will not be listed. It is also probably wise for me to point out that in writing this book, I have borrowed ideas quite liberally from others. I doubt seriously if there is an original idea in it. This is a sort of blanket yet respectful acknowledgement of all the creators of these ideas which I have used without stopping to give official credit. At best, Robert and I have arranged what we think are brilliant ideas in a manner to support what we believe. If the reader is taken by this book and the line of thought it provides, then we have accomplished our purpose in writing it. Let me make clear, however, that there is no greater idea in this book that provides the catalytic force to empower the individual, to move him to take immediate action, than the idea provided by R. Nelson Nash and his infinite banking concept, IBC. There will be more to say about Nelson and IBC later. However, I will say now that it was Nelson who first suggested that I write this book. With each economic article I wrote and distributed through the internet, his encouragement by way of a personal phone call would follow. I would have never conceived of the idea to write a book containing my thoughts had it not been for his urgings, at least not in the direction he kept pushing me. Nelson, a longtime student of Austrian economics spanning 52 years, counseled me and spoke with me about the mentoring he had received earlier in his life from Leonard Reed, founder of the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE. The ideas for Nelson's book on the infinite banking concept had come directly from Austrian economics. It was these same conversations with Nelson Nash that I would in turn begin to share with Robert Murphy. Slowly, over a period of a year, Robert became convinced and convicted of what he was hearing. His first moment of real clarity came one day over lunch with Paul Cleveland. Robert had just finished reading Nelson's book, and by the time lunch was over, Robert understood the significance of what the book was explaining, and soon thereafter implemented the process for himself. The Sound Money Solution. The day Robert Murphy committed to co-author this book with me is a day I shall never forget, simply because of the unusual and unexpected way in which it happened. However, it is precisely because of the way it happened that explains and proves the explosive vision the ideas in this book produce. To recount this special day and begin to put it into proper perspective, keep in mind that up until then, Robert and I had been vigorously involved in numerous conversations about the human predicament in today's economic environment. Robert, as a scholar and expert in Austrian economics, could explain why things were the way they were academically. He obviously could expound on these problems prolifically, having written several books, including study guides to Mises' Human Action and Murray Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State, not to leave out the countless articles for various independent libertarian think tanks. However, thoroughly explaining and diagnosing the problem of our nation and our world was not the main issue. What everyone desperately wanted to know was how to fix it. Additionally, we both understood the sound money solution well and believed in it, knowing that it was anchored by solid Austrian thinking. We knew all too well what was required to effect the kind of national change the sound money solution called for. But the problem was that the sound money solution's required steps were highly unlikely to ever be implemented, and sadly, we both knew it. Evidence for this was in the fact that the sound money solution was put forth decades ago, and yet, in spite of all the advances and growth the Austrian school has had domestically and internationally, the sound money solution was next to impossible to ever see implemented. Robert and I were both certainly doing our part in spreading the message, with each of us speaking to various groups throughout the country in our respective fields. But the process, we readily admitted, was slow and discouraging at times. We also knew our goal was not attempting to convince the entire nation, certainly not 300 million people. Austrian economists know that 10% of the population would most likely be enough to turn public opinion in our favor. We simply do not have anywhere close to that 10%. Obviously, we needed more people, but not just anybody. We needed the right kind of people, responsible and productive people. We needed people that would get involved and stay involved. Also, there needed to be a burning passion inside these people in order to see this change all the way to its successful end. What was clearly missing was some kind of individual incentive, but one that could work with the main tenets of the sound money solution. What we wanted most was to break through the general pessimism that has hung like a black cloud over our school's predecessors. Henry Hazlitt, one of the most recognizable of the Austrian economists, because of his affiliation with the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and Newsweek, and also the author of the best-selling book, Economics in One Lesson, described this particular pessimism in one of his last public speeches as he passed the baton over to the next generation. When I look back on my own career, I can find plenty of reasons for discouragement. Personal discouragement. I have not lacked for industry. I have written a dozen books. For most of 50 years, from age 20, I have been writing practically every weekday, news items, editorials, columns, articles, some 10,000 words, and in print, the verbal equivalent of about 150 average-length books. And yet, what have I accomplished? The world is enormously more socialized than when I began. Yet, in spite of this, I am hopeful. After all, I'm still in good health. I'm still free to write. I'm still free to write unpopular opinions. And I'm keeping at it. And so are many of you. So I bring you this message. Be of good cheer. Be of good spirit. If the battle is not yet won, it is not yet lost either. Even those of us who have reached and passed our 70th birthdays cannot afford to rest on our oars and spend the rest of our lives dozing in the Florida sun. The times call for courage. The times call for hard work. But if the demands are high, it is because the stakes are even higher. They are nothing less than the future of human liberty, which means the future of civilization. What Robert and I began to do next was to get honest with each other. We agreed that our individual concern with regards to what we are experiencing in our political and economic affairs currently could be summed up in our knowing what ill effects all this economic upheaval is having on people's ability to make a living. We did not shy away from this reality. We had several very in-depth and personal discussions about this concern. We knew that for most of us in America, the need to be able to make a living is, and always has been, a crucial fact of life. It is the business from which we never retire. In fact, it is difficult to imagine any human being who is not preoccupied with this economic endeavor. In whatever manner we try to explain our society or our government in terms of the past, present, or the future, we cannot do it and ignore economic man and his innate need to make a living. And then it happened. All of a sudden, the entire theme of this book, from beginning to end, hit Robert like a 2x4 across the head. His eyes widened with utter amazement, and he exclaimed with excitement, "That's it!" Moments later, he admitted that the vision hit him with such force that he had not even seen it coming. It had never dawned on him until that very moment that what I, Paul, and Nelson had been talking about all this time was actually step two of the three steps of the sound money solution, privatized banking. However, the spectacular and unbelievable part about it was that an individual could actually go into privatized banking right now. There was no need to wait on government to change. There was no need for the sound money solution to be accepted and put forth into public policy. Private banking could be done immediately, and it could be done by virtually anyone. Our creative energy suddenly soared, and the missing incentive we had been searching for suddenly became clear and apparent. The answer, the missing link, was simply the connecting of this innate need within man, the need to make a living, with the sound money solution. The key was step two of the sound money solution, the business of banking, privatized banking, the most profitable business in the world. It could be implemented right now by any individual citizen. In this introduction, I should also say a few words on the layout of the book. I have been giving PowerPoint presentations on these matters to various audiences of financial professionals, and the reaction has been astonishing. Even groups of bankers are absorbing the information. Most of them had no idea how their own industry really worked. On the other hand, Robert's main arena was in print. As a former college professor and the author of several books, Robert obviously can present the Austrian ideas in the traditional form. He too has found growing popular interest in these ideas because of the financial crisis. In the present book, Robert and I obeyed the popular adage, "If it ain't broke, don't fix it." That is to say, in part one of the book, I am the primary author, and I did my best to translate my PowerPoint presentations into book form. Robert, on the other hand, is the primary author of part two. There, he tries to distill the most important points from the Austrian tradition in order for the reader to understand the sound money solution. The simple listing of its three bullet points will make little sense without some background knowledge of how a free market economy actually works. Because of the book's structure, it was unavoidable that there is some redundancy. Robert and I treat many of the crucial topics, inflation, fractional reserve banking, the nature of money, and so on, in our own ways. We hope that part one provides a quick overview of the relevant topics, convincing the reader of their importance without the use of intimidating jargon that too often paralyzes comprehension. Then in part two, we pass through many of the same issues, but in greater depth. Finally, in part three, we explain the basics of Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept and show its contribution to the achievement of the sound money solution. I'm sure that some readers who already have a deep knowledge of monetary and banking affairs may find portions of our treatment simplistic, but I ask you to keep in mind that we need to spread this message to a larger group of Americans if we're to have any hope of turning the tide. These are very important issues that will affect the type of country in which our children and grandchildren live. Especially in part one, we've tried to boil down these arcane and intimidating concepts into descriptions that anyone can understand. The fate of our money, and indeed our country, are too important to be left to the experts. All too often, I have personally seen very intelligent women who concentrate on other responsibilities and allow their husbands to take care of the finances. Such women are one of the primary target audiences for whom we are writing. Indeed, many men will reject the common sense and conservative financial strategies we explain in this book because they're too easy and too timid. But when it comes to a household's savings, simplicity is good. We've seen what the smartest guys in the room did on Wall Street. We urge stay-at-home spouses to read deeply on these matters and to take a more active role in their financial future. As a final point in this introduction, let me acknowledge that our book has an explicitly American bias. We are writing this book for our fellow American citizens, though of course the lessons of Austrian economics are universally applicable. There are three main reasons for our emphasis on the United States. First, there is the simple problem that foreign readers may not be able to obtain whole life insurance policies configured in the way Nelson Nash recommends. In contrast, American readers have several appropriate insurers to choose from who can cater to a client wishing to implement IBC. Second, the Federal Reserve is by far the most powerful force in the world economy. The folly of the Zimbabwe Central Bank only ruined the lives of a small fraction of the global population. In contrast, if Ben Bernanke does not alter course soon, billions of people will suffer the consequences. Third, we believe that the lovers of liberty must make a final stand in the United States. To paraphrase Ronald Reagan, if we lose liberty here, there's nowhere left to go. Just as the fall of the Soviet Union proved the futility of communism to many pragmatists who would not bother with abstract arguments, by the same token, the collapse of the United States will convince the world that capitalism, too, does not work. It would be an erroneous conclusion. We certainly do not have a free market in operation. But that is the verdict history would give on America's brief fling with limited government. The quintessential American political tradition is one of individual liberty and economic freedom. Even as American politicians trample the Constitution, they still pay lip service to its clauses. Although the average American's commitment to the principles of individualism and private property grow weaker with each generation, even so, there is a rich heritage that we hope to rekindle. We can succeed, and we must try. L. Carlos Lara, Nashville, Tennessee, June 2010.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. Once again, that was the introduction to the book, How Privatized Banking Really Works, the book Carlos Lahr and I co-authored. If you want to get your hands on the physical book, go to our website, which is larmurphy.com, and that's LARA-Murphy.com, and then click on the Resources tab in the top middle, and then scroll down, and you'll see our book is listed on the bottom there with all the other books. Okay, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.